This is Robert Bosnak on January 10th, 2014. The Phenomenal Power of Asclepian Dream Incubation. This was recorded on a DVD. They're available in the library at the Seattle Jung Society.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much, Jung Society of Seattle, to invite me again. And I thought it was longer ago, so... Do we have to move this up?
We're going to hear you.
Yeah, that doesn't matter.
Yeah. Is that better?
So should I do my Elvis Presley imitation? No. Okay. Love me tender, love me do. Okay. I usually try to write a book every decade, and now I'm in the middle of my seventh decade. And my book of my 60s is going to be about the panacea, because I've been particularly interested in that because of the confluence of alchemy and healing, which is part of my interest. And what I will be talking to you about tonight is about our work at the Santa Barbara Healing Sanctuary in Santa Barbara that was founded by Steve Eisenstadt and myself. Steve, of course, many of you know, founded Pacifica Graduate Institute. And this is not connected to Pacifica, but we founded it together because we have this common interest in dreaming. And I will tell you a little bit about the Asclepian tradition and the way that we're trying to revive that. And then I will give you an extensive case presentation, which is the tradition in our psychoanalytic communities to give case presentations, which is a particular literary genre that has as much to do with reality as do good novels. I will be talking a little bit about dreaming, and let me start to say something about yesterday. Maybe some, I don't know if anybody of you was there, but we started a course together with Patricia Berry on the internet on alchemy, because we're interested, both of us. Pat, of course, was married to James Hillman, and I was analyzed by him. He was my training analyst. We're working on the book Alchemical Psychology by James Hillman and trying to really go deeply into it, going sentence by sentence, to really get a sense of what alchemy can be if you look at it in a different way than Jung did. If you look at the way that Jung worked with alchemy, and I don't want to step on people's toes, I couldn't have thought any of my thoughts without Jung, but of course in the 43 years that I've been doing this, I have developed my own thoughts. And when you look at the way that Jung is looking at alchemy, he looks at it from the point of view of a progression. It's a movement towards a conjunction. That is not the interest that I have in alchemy. I have the interest in alchemy is very small, specific operations that they do that feel very similar to operations that we do when we work with images. Because alchemy has their own imagery is wild. It is all over the place, and the way that we look at these images is in a state of perplexity. And that's the way that we look at dreams. The moment you get presented a dream, if you're not perplexed, then you're not doing the right thing. If you know immediately what the dream is about, then you're probably in a resistance phenomenon. Because dreams, by their nature, come from a different realm. They come from a different world that is experienced differently, that is presented, that presents itself differently. You now all know that I have a jacket. And so what I think is important to realize is that when Asclepian medicine began, and it began probably about 600, 800 BC, or a little bit after Homer, in the time of Homer, he's still talking about Asclepius as a physician, and who had two sons who were part of the Trojan War. And so if we take that as the legend, the legendary Asclepius, the great physician, then that would be about 1300 BC around, if it's about the time of the Trojan War. And of course, this is all legend. We're dealing with legendary history. And he is said to have come from Trica in the north of Greece, and there became such a legend as a physician, and the main thing that got him in trouble with the gods was that he revived someone from the dead, and Hades got very angry, because you don't do that. You don't steal people. And from Hades, at least. And so he was slain, and he lost both his life and his mortality. He became immortal, became a god, and that means that he became increasingly powerful. And Hippocrates, who you all, I'm sure, know of, and those of you who are physicians, many of you will have sworn by him. Hippocrates called himself a descendant of Asclepius in the 18th generation. Up until the time of Hippocrates, what was happening was... we're getting paper. From that, around the time of Hippocrates, the Asclepian tradition was still a family tradition. The people who were family of Asclepius, descendants from Asclepius, are called the Asclepiads. If you want to read about all this, there is the best book that is written is by Adelson and Adelson. Adelson and Adelson were a German couple that went, of course, German. They went over all the literature that was extant about Asclepius. They went through all the herms that are still there, all the stelae where the treatments are written on. And they have collected everything in around 1945, and I think their book has been in print ever since. It's called Asclepius, Adelson and Adelson. It's the best historical references. We have a lot of case histories from that, and of course the case histories interest us a lot. Because apparently, with their treatment, they didn't just treat what we call psychological illness. No, they treated physical illness, because people would bring to the sanctuaries little statues of what was healed, and we see feet and we see arms. And so the healing was a physical kind of healing, next to probably also psychological. Hippocrates was the big watershed. He had his sanctuary in Kos, in the island of Kos, where you can still see it. It's still existent. And there he made a move that that Americans will very much understand. He said, if you pay for it, you can come. You don't have to be family anymore. And so he started the first medical school in Kos. And the big change that he created was, he said, illness does not come from the gods. The gods are not the ones who send the illness. Illness comes from nature. So, physis. And every illness has its own physis. You have to find the physis, written physic, but then with an S in the end. You have to find the natural cause. So he was looking for natural causes. So he threw out much of the ideas of that had existed before, that it was given by the gods. He started to look for physical causes, natural causes, physical causes, because physis means nature. So for natural causes, physical causes, and but the one thing that he didn't throw out, the one thing that stayed, and that stayed for over 1,000 years, was dream incubation. Dream incubation remained central to Western medicine from about 600-700 BC till about 500 AD, when the church ended it because they wanted to have the franchise on Revelation. And what was happening was that the Asclepian medicine works by way of revelation. It works by way of having the imagination reveal, and I will explain to you what I mean by imagination, having the imagination reveal to you what the healing, where the healing would come from. So let me explain to you what I mean by imagination. As you've heard, the field that I have explored mainly in my life is a field called embodied imagination, the way that imagination lives as body. This is a field that was directly coming from C.G. Jung. Jung actually describes the birth of the field of embodied imagination in the Red Book. All of you know that the Red Book was first a series of little black books in which he wrote down his experiences starting in about in December, the end of December of 1913. So we just had the 100-year anniversary of the Red Book, basically, of the beginning of it, and thereby 100-year anniversary of the beginning of embodied imagination. Why am I emphatic to call it embodied imagination? Let's go back to the Red Book and the way he describes it. So Jung here is has just split up from Freud. He feels very isolated. This is a feeling. This is not a literal thing. He's surrounded by people. He's surrounded by the Zurich School. He's surrounded by tons of women. He's surrounded by people. But he feels very isolated, and in this state of isolation, he gets all these images that begin to overwhelm him. And here he is. He's professor at the ETH, which is like MIT. I don't know the equivalent on the West Coast. It's a very prestigious position that he's in. And here he is getting all these visions, and he thinks he's going psychotic. And then in around Christmas of last year, 100 years ago, so a month ago, 100 years ago, he makes a very fateful decision, which I think is has become important for all of psychology. And he describes it in the following way. He says, "I let myself drop." And then what he describes, so this is the first thing. He let himself drop, so there is a moment of surrender. That's the first step in the whole work of embodied imagination. There's a surrender to another world. It is frightening. It is very frightening. What he describes is, "I'm falling along a rock face." He describes the rock face. There are caves in there, and he describes the rock face. So it is an embodied presence that he's describing. It's a rock face. It is actually there. But the most important thing is, he says, "When I land, I feel that I'm standing up to my ankles in mud." So the first experience of being present to this world is not with the head, it's with the feet and standing in mud. He's standing in a real world. And we have to speak a moment, we talk about the word real, right? The word real in German, of course, is very different from the word real as we use it, because the word real comes from res, from the Latin thing. So when we use the word real, we speak about thingliness. That's the translation of reality, thingliness. Thingliness, because res is a thing. And when the Germans talk about reality, they talk about Wirklichkeit. Wirklichkeit is that which has effects. So it's a very different notion of what reality is. That which has effects, therefore, is real. And when Jung talks about the reality of the soul, he talks about the Wirklichkeit der Seele, about the effectivity of the soul. And so much of the stuff has gotten lost in translation. One of the things that has gotten lost in translation, we owe to Strachey when he translated Freud, which is the word soul. Freud didn't talk about psyche. Freud talked about Seele, about soul. So when it crossed the Atlantic, it lost soul. And I think that the great child Bruno Bettelheim writes about that. And so here with reality, we lose the sense of that which has effect. And the effect that of the reality of the embodied imagination is that it's physical. He can feel it with his feet. Not only can he feel it with his feet, with his body, the mud is embodied. The rock face is embodied. So imagination in its most pure form, and I take dreaming to be the most pure form of imagination. So I take dreaming, in a dream, the whole world around us is imagination. Right? Here, when we sit, the world around us, yes, is imagination. We are imagining the world. Kant says, without imagination, you couldn't organize the world. So imagination organizes this world, but there's physical reality as well. So there's an interface between physical reality and imagination. In dreaming, there's only imagination. So that's why I take, I'm now not talking dreaming from the point of view of the current notions of brain and all that stuff. That's something else. I'm talking about the phenomenology of dreaming. I consider myself an aspiring phenomenologist. I try to be a phenomenologist, which I think is one of the most difficult things in the world, to be a practical phenomenologist. And I will tell you in a moment why that is so. As we are dealing with imagination through dreaming, then the first thing that you will notice is that an image is an environment. And that is very central to all my thinking. An image is an environment in which you find yourself. Just think about yesterday's dream. It was not primarily a story. You were somewhere. And that is, my interest has been to go all over the world to ask people, what do you dream? How do you dream about dreaming? I'm very interested in how different people's dream. And I've been in many different places, and there's one answer that always comes, and that to me has become the definition of dreaming. I was somewhere and something happened. So that is the definition to me of dreaming. Usually, and from there on it changes, because as you wake up, then your culture begins to define what a dream is, because then suddenly you know that you're dreaming. I'm not talking about a lucid dream, because lucid dreams are really rare, and I'm not really focusing on that. A lucid dream is where you know that you're dreaming. A common dream is you know that you're awake. You don't think you're awake. You know you're awake. Like now, you know you're awake. You don't think you're awake. You know that you're awake. And in the same way in dreaming, you know that you're awake. You know that you're in an environment that is entirely real, an environment that can scare you, an environment where you can fall in love, an environment where you can taste food, an environment where you can smell terrible things when you go to the bathroom. All these kind of things happen. Your whole body is involved, and you're living in a world that is a real world, and I call it a wild world. That's why one of my books is called Tracks in the Wilderness of Dreaming, because that is a world of untamed imagination. And untamed imagination is very frightening, because we spend much of our lives to tame the imagination. That's what Jung did. He tamed the wild imagination with a whole meta-narrative about anima and animus and self, and all these kind of things was a meta-narrative that he created to tame the wildness of imagination. So I, as a phenomenologist, I moved that out of the way. And I owe that to James Hillman, because he spent his whole life trying to deconstruct Jung and get rid of the meta-narratives that are actually hiding the wildness of imagination and the creative force of imagination. We can talk about that if you have questions about it. When I speak about imagination, I speak about a reality. I speak about a reality that we encounter every night, and we encounter it much more than every night. We encounter it all the time. It is and then you have to see that I come from a tradition. My tradition is very much, I owe very much to an Islamic scholar called Henri Corbin, who I met when I was secretary to the Aronos Foundation in the 70s. And Aronos was the place where initially Jung came to present his most advanced ideas, and then a lot of others came, Buber and Tillich and And Corbin was one of them. And he always said that there was a great cataclysm that happened in Western culture, and it happened around the 11th, 12th century. And that cataclysm was that the culture moved from a Neoplatonic tradition to an Aristotelian tradition. The Neoplatonic tradition takes imagination as a reality, as a form of reality. It is a place. It is a place where you can go and a place where you can have vision, so it's a visionary tradition. It's a place, and it's a third place. There is the intelligible world, which now we would call either spirit, or we would call mathematics, or we call mind. And then there is the world of matter. And then for the Neoplatonists, there's this world in between, which is the world of the real imagination. That's a world in between that is equally real as the world of the intelligibility and the world of matter. It is an in-between world that is equally real. During the last 800 years, it dropped out. And as we became Aristotelian, which is a dualism, which has mind and matter, which created the mind and matter conundrum that we still are dealing with, the imagination became the opposite of reality. The imagination moved from a reality to Disney World. Disney World, but Disney describes it, actually, that he doesn't like the endings of stories. I don't know if you saw the movie Saving Mr. Banks. He describes that he doesn't like the endings of the stories, so he creates imagination to get out of reality. And his whole Disney World idea is to get a place outside of reality. That is the epitome of the Western attitude to imagination as it has developed over the last 800 years. When we look 800 years back, imagination was a form of reality in which you could meet people, in which you could meet beings, in which you could encounter what were called the daimones, the beings that live in that world. And in many other traditions, like in the tradition that you were talking about in Brazil and many other traditions, they still have these daimones with which they are conversant. In our tradition, it has either become hallucination or it has become Disney. But there is not this sense anymore that Jung started again and brought back into the culture that there is an in-between world that is equally real. And the question then is, can this in-between world that is equally real to the physical world, I call this the embodied world because they exist in embodied states, they exist in embodied presences, can this embodied world have an influence for us, or can it lead to us to medical applications that were similar to the applications that were brought about by Asclepian medicine? And the answer, of course, is yes, otherwise I wouldn't be talking to you. I would be just very sad. I began to be interested in reviving Asclepian medicine basically because of an illness that I had, which made me spend about 11 months in the hospital, and then they couldn't find it, and then I went into analysis through many different roads. I ended up in analysis, and during my analysis, my illness, which is a chronic illness, which I still have, but all the symptoms disappeared. And the doctors now say, well, keep on doing what you're doing. You shouldn't be in this condition. So I found that working on images directly affected my body. So I became interested in Zurich already in how that works. How does it work when you work on images in an embodied way? How does that affect the body? Well, I still have no answer, but I'm trying it. And I think that part of what is very important, and you find that in all the healing sanctuaries, especially the great ones, the two greatest healing sanctuaries in the old culture was Epidaurus in Greece and Pergamon in Turkey. And both have a huge theater connected to them. The one in Epidaurus, if you know it, has a theater that is considered to be the greatest theater of antiquity. It's a place when you walk all the way up to the top and you drop a coin on the stage, you can hear it on top. And even for us older people, you can still hear it. And in Pergamon, actually, they have, and I've just been told this by Jill Fisher, who just returned from that. Jill Fisher is my my main colleague with whom I'm setting all these things up. She's the clinical director of the Santa Barbara Healing Sanctuary, and we started Cyber Dream Work together. We've worked together for 25 years. She just came back from there, and she said, Robbie, there is a theater in the Abaton. And that, to me, was very surprising. Now, let me tell you what an abaton is. An abaton is very important, a very important concept. The word abaton means the inaccessible place, the untrodden place. Every sanctuary was situated around an abaton. In the abaton, the people would go and dream. In the abaton were the clinae, from which we have the word clinic. And so on the clinae, you would lie down and you would have your dreams, if you were lucky, and the god would visit you, so you would have a visitation of the daimon, and the daimon was Asclepius, and we will see in the person who I will present to you that the daimon in modern days can be a movie star. And you would have that encounter, and the encounter itself would be healing. And so in the abaton of Pergamon, there was a theater. And I have found, and I will try to substantiate that a little bit, I have found that one of the most important things of a sanctuary is theater. Embodied imagination, of course, is very strongly related to theater. I've worked with embodied imagination with many theater companies, the Royal Shakespeare Company in Stratford and the Bell Shakespeare Company in Sydney, Australia, and several other, and I've worked with writers. And so that's one of my interests. If you look at Stanislavski and the misinterpretation of Stanislavski, which became the method in the United States, when Adler went to Stella Adler went to Stanislavski and told him what the method was about, he said, "Oh God, you don't understand any of it. It has nothing to do with it." But anyway, that's where we were, and it created great actors like Robert De Niro and Marlon Brando and one of the greats of all times, Marilyn Monroe. And so it was a school of acting that came from the following notion, that the body has imagination. If you are on a hot stage and you have to shiver because it's cold and you're sitting under these hot lamps, then they would say, focus on the last moment that you were really freezing and you could feel it in your ears. So you focus on your ears, and as you focus on your ears and you feel that freezing, then you can start shivering. Your body will start shivering, even though in the physical world you're hot. You will still start shivering because in the imaginal world the body becomes ice cold. And that is something that we employ in embodied imagination, and I will show you how we do that. But why would it be important for medicine to use that ability that we have to identify with what I call non-habitual states, to identify with non-habitual states? What medical use can that have? Let me quote David Livingstone. David Livingstone wrote his missionary travels and researches in South Africa in 1857. And he describes how he was being attacked by a lion. And since most of us have not been attacked by a lion, it's interesting to hear it from him. Growling horribly close to my ear, he shook me as a terrier dog does a rat. The shock produced a sort of dreaminess. in which there was no sense of pain nor feeling of terror. Though quite conscious of all that was happening, it was like what patients under the influence of chloroform describe, who see all the operation but feel not the knife. The shake annihilated fear and allowed no sense of horror in looking round at the beast. This peculiar state is probably produced in all animals killed by carnivora. So this is the description, an extreme description of a non-habitual state. So our system is able to move into states that are not usual. Usually, you would expect being torn apart by a lion would be pretty scary and intensely painful. But the body does something. The body does something which makes it, creates a natural anesthesia without losing consciousness, without losing awareness. So the question is, this natural ability of the body, is that something that we can access by way of imagination? Because if we have that natural ability, the negative part of this natural ability, for instance, you can see in PTSD, where a person is walking down the street, coming back from one of the wars, walking down the street, and there is a loud noise, and suddenly they're back in this whole environment where bombs are going off, they can smell it, everything is right there. That is what PTSD is all about. The world of imagination forms entirely solid bodied around them, and they are convinced at that moment that they're back there, that it can be just a fraction of a moment, but for that moment, the imagination creates that world again. So the embodied imagination is entirely powerful at that moment. So the question is, can we create an environment in which the imagination is so strong that it will have a healing effect, that it will trigger these ways that the body has, the ways that the body has that we've always known about to heal itself, but that needs to be triggered? Because usually once, the moment that you're sick, or when you feel you're getting there, something in your system is no longer working so well, and something in your system cannot do the natural healing process that goes on all the time. I think if we didn't have this ongoing natural healing process, we would probably die as an infant, because the body is constantly regenerating, constantly healing itself, and then at a certain moment it gets interrupted, and that's when we get sick. So let me introduce the Santa Barbara Healing Sanctuary and how we have been doing it. The Santa Barbara Healing Sanctuary was an idea that I've had since 1973. When I became a staff analyst at the Klinik am Söderberg, the Jungian training hospital, the Jungian training psychiatric hospital in Zurich. And that was started by one of Jung's pupils called C.A. Meyer, and who also wrote the book Ancient Incubation and Modern Psychotherapy. And Meyer, and especially a psychiatrist who was trained by Ludwig Binswanger, Heinrich Fiertz. He was my chief of psychiatry. And this was the first Asclepian clinic that I had ever heard of, where they did the Asclepian tradition with dream work three times a week, but they didn't have many of the other things that we now use as integrative medicine. This was in the 70s and the 60s, and so that was not yet very much done. The food was not in the same way nutritious the way that we now think about what food should be like, and there was no yoga and meditation and all the things that we now believe are part of integrative medicine and we use at the Santa Barbara Healing Sanctuary. It was not there yet. But the idea was that the whole treatment was focused on three times a week dream work. And The interesting thing for me was that I came there as a 23, 24-year-old. Now, I was 25 at that time. I came to the Jung Institute at 23. And at 25, I was given the most difficult cases because Fiertz thought that the beginner should get the most difficult cases. Because the beginners didn't yet know that you can't help people. And so we would get the most impossible cases. And I learned a great deal there. And I became very interested to see, because for me it was physical healing that was taking place, what happens if you do this for physical illness? What happens when you do this for illness prevention? And when in around 2000 I started to talk about this with Steve Eisenstadt, he said, oh, he was very interested in that too, because he's also just had taken a group to Epidaurus, and I had taken a group to Epidaurus in the early 90s. He was very interested, and so we started to try and raise funds, and it ended up that I just put my whole retirement stuff in there because nobody was going to give us any money. And we opened up in September of 11, and the person that I will be talking to you about, I interviewed a year out because I'm very interested in what happens afterwards. You can go to a health spa and people come out and they all feel wonderful. So that's not that interesting. I mean, it's interesting, and everybody who comes from the sanctuary said it was the greatest experience of their life and all that kind of stuff. It's wonderful, I'm very happy, but it doesn't interest me very much. What interests me is what happens, is there still an effect a year later? So that's what I want to talk about. And I have not talked about this before, so I thought I might as well talk about it here. What do we offer at the Santa Barbara Healing Sanctuary? Well, we have 10 daily sessions of dream work, individual dream work. Then there is integrative therapies, aquatic therapy that's called Watsu, where you're being moved through water. There is a diet. You have a dietitian who takes a whole anamnesis and sets up a diet. There's a gourmet cook. And there's yoga and meditation. And then on the basis of the dreaming, you do art, you do dream theater, you do journaling. And there are art forms that then increase the experience that you've had in your dreaming. What is very important in it is that it's done in a group. The maximum of the group is about 6 or 7. And the group becomes very close during the time, and the center of it is sleeping in the abaton, where the group, in a big room that usually goes down, people sleep in one space, but surrounded by, we have made a concession to being in the 21st century where people want privacy. So they are together in the same room, but they are surrounded by pods of screens so that they are still in the same room, but there is a modicum of privacy. And I don't know if Jill would agree, Jill and I do the individual dream work, that there are three phases in this work. One is the entry phase, then there's going into the abaton, and then there's the exit phase where you go back home. And I will give you, of this person who I'll call N, dreams from these three phases, and you can see how it develops. N came to the healing sanctuary because of generalized pain all over her body, completely intractable, and it gets many of these diagnoses like fibromyalgia. It gets diagnoses that basically is, if you don't know what it is, give it a name. And like somebody who had red spots on his hand, and the doctor said, oh, that is da-da-da-da, and it was a Latin word for red spots on the hands. She came in, and the main problem that she had was very, very severe TMJ, temporal mandibular joint problem. It was so bad that she could hardly sleep. It was terrible. These things are terrible, and I can tell you from experience, because that was interesting. Let me start with that. So I've never worked with somebody who had TMJ like that. I mean, it was so painful. And after the sanctuary, for 3 months I had TMJ, which I've never had. It's the first time ever that it jumped over. And because people always ask me, how can you keep it away? And then I say, well, if you really experience it and you really go deeply into it, then usually it just goes by. I can't say that anymore. I was caught. I was completely caught in this. And you'll see through the work how we got into some kind of a state of merger that is very similar to what the shamanic people describe, where the shaman takes on the illness. It's something that I never want to do again. I never want to be a shaman again. I'm an analyst. So let me give you N's dreams. First, the dream is the entry dream, the first dream that she presented. It is, I am driving around in circles, and I note that I'm driving around a prison, and I'm driving around in circles, and suddenly I realize, oh my God, I don't have to be here, and I drive off. That is the first. The way that we work it is that we get this sense, we first work the sense of going around in circles and feeling how she's sitting in the car going around in circles, feel that going around in circles in her body. And as she senses this going around in circles, is there something the matter? I see somebody crawling. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So as she's going around in circles, we go to this moment where she realizes that she can go out, and that is this moment of opening up. And so that is the whole experience of. So that is the experience of the dream. That is an embodied experience of the dream from the perspective of self. Okay? The interesting thing comes, of course, when you start shifting perspectives away from self. Because we could have worked it from the point of view of the prison. We could have worked it from the point of view of the car. We could have worked it from the point of view of the road. Because the interesting thing, of course, about dreaming is everything in the dream is being imagined. The car is imagined just as much as N is imagined, because N is lying in her bed in the sanctuary. Physically, she's being imagined as sitting in the car. The car is being imagined. Everything is being imagined. And therefore, what is possible in the work that we're doing is you can move out of the perspective that you're identified with, which I call habitual consciousness. You can move out of habitual consciousness and move into a non-habitual state, like, for instance, the prison, or like, for instance, what we will do later on, another character. And in this non-habitual state, you will find completely different things. This happened in the extreme form to Livingstone when he spontaneously moved into this anesthetized state. He was in a non-habitual state. And the question that I've been asking from the beginning is, how can we get into this non-habitual state? Because, for instance, especially this is very interesting with pain, and we're focusing very much on pain because we have done the first pain studies at Columbia University to show that actually, I'll tell you about those studies. I'll go on till 10 past, okay? We did a study. Jill was a therapist, Jill Fisher. 25 people that were just told, if you want to be part of a pain study, you're going to get $50 or $100. So they went on the streets in New York and they trawled and they found people from 25 different cultures. And Jill did with them an embodied imagination exercise on a memory. And first she worked it from the point of view of self. And these were pleasant memories. I'm sitting with my mother and she's cuddling me and I feel really good. When it was done from the point of self, from the point of view of self, the pain reduction, this is actually laboratory pain, right, where they give you pain stimuli to the point where of heat, where it's like the heat of a cup of coffee that's so hot that you can't hold it anymore. So they give you pain stimuli. It's a wonderful thing for sadists. And people rate it. And so when they did the rating afterwards, they found that when the person is identified with self, the pain reduction is about the same as the pain reduction for deep relaxation. But the interesting part was, when you become identified with a non-habitual state, like when you work the memory from the point of view of the couch, or when you work the memory from the point of view of the horse instead of the rider, then the pain reduction was enormous, was much greater than the pain reduction of many analgesics. So we know, and that's where we're continuing now with the research, that if you move out of the habitual state into a non-habitual state, the pain reduction is much greater. Okay, so this was the entry dream. Now there is two dreams that were dreamt in the Abaton. One dream, the first dream in the Abaton was I'm driving. The driving keeps continuing as a theme. I am driving and I see I have to park in a huge parking lot. I have to find a parking. All the parking spots are taken. And I am just driving around. I have to park my car. I see an open spot. I take a beeline for it. There's somebody else taking a beeline for it. And I just go right in with this attitude of, I dare you. And so this whole attitude of, I dare you, that goes right deeply into the body, was a kind of a state that was unfamiliar to her, where she could really stand up for herself. And it moved into a stance that was in her legs, that she could feel in her legs. That was the second dream. The third dream was the most important one for her that she talked about. That is what I would say is the emergence of Asclepius. I'm sitting on a couch with Robert De Niro. And my daughter is there, and Robert De Niro is completely uninterested in any convention. He sits with his cocked head, and I cannot imitate Robert De Niro. I won't even try. And he has the Robert De Niro smirk on his face. And it doesn't work very well. Anyway, you know it. And he doesn't care at all about that, and he feels entirely free to do anything he wants. Now we do a transit. We first work it from the perspective of her and feeling how she's embarrassed that her daughter is there and all tense up. Then we go into the posture, the cocked head of Robert De Niro, the smirk, and I don't let the person do it entirely, because then you get into that you can't do it. I mean, most of us are not mimics that are doing it that well. So she gets into the smirk of Robert De Niro. Then she begins to feel his body. And as she feels the body, it's completely free. It is completely open. It is completely non-caring about any convention. It is completely relaxed and unflappable. And as she gets into that body, the pain reduces dramatically. And this is the Robert De Niro one, the Robert De Niro image, where she identifies with that, where she identifies with the with that Asclepian character, something that she uses whenever she tenses up. Whenever she tenses up, as a conditioned reflex, Robert De Niro is there, and her whole body changes into a non-habitual state. Of course, note that the man is called Robert, and that I ended up with a TMJ. There is another dream that was an Abaton dream, and that is there is a huge fire going on, and the fireman is pulled into the fire by the backdraft. So there is this something is being pulled into this enormous heat that is going on, that is moving through her body, that is everywhere. I don't know. I can't interpret it. I have no idea. But there is this moment of the fireman, the man that is involved with the fire, who can no longer withstand it, is being pulled in. We didn't get a chance to work that very much. At least she doesn't remember the work on that very much, just that it had enormous fear and dread in it. Then there are two dreams that are part of going home. So these were dreamt after the Abaton. The first is being kidnapped. And as she is being kidnapped, the people want to see what's happening in her mouth. And she has a bite guard in her mouth. And they take it out of her mouth, they break it in three pieces, and then they leave. And she puts it back in her mouth, broken. So this whole thing here, something gets broken up here. And it's very painful. It's a very painful process. And the last dream that she has just before leaving is, I'm arriving at the airport, I'm coming home, and I'm being picked up by my husband and several of my friends, and I don't want to think about them. I don't want to be involved with them. I just want to stay with the experience that I have. And as she was feeling the experience that she was having, she calls it her happy feet. Her feet began to move by themselves, like, and she described it, like the feet of a child who is sitting on a chair that is too high, and the feet begin to dance. She called that her happy feet. And so here are several images that she pulls back, and now I'm going to, because we have to stop, about the interview that I did a year afterwards. She said, when I get into my pain, several of these images get triggered. The happy feet get triggered, Robert De Niro gets triggered. I notice the fear of the backdraft. I notice that this is broken up, and actually the way that it's broken up is that after the sanctuary, she said, I was able to have people touch my body. Before, I was not, so I could not do physiotherapy, I could not do acupuncture, I could not do massage, I couldn't do any of that. And that would have been really great if I could, but I couldn't be touched. It hurt so much. After the sanctuary, I could be touched. So I started a program of physiotherapy, I started acupuncture, I started massage, and all that has been loosening up my body next to all the images that she was using. She continued her nutrition support that was figured out at the sanctuary. And she feels that the outer crust of her pain, of the illness, has been dissolved. The pain, there is still a lot of pain. I mean, this is not a magic bullet. There's still a lot of pain, but it's different. Now the doctors can work at something that is structurally the matter, because the outer structure of that has dissolved, and now there's something structurally the matter, and they're finding that there may be a fracture somewhere underneath. And so there might be something physical there that they haven't found, and they're looking now for for that part, and I don't know how that is going to continue, but they think that there is some kind of a fracture or slip disc. I don't know what they are talking about now. But she feels that what is happening is that the first layer of pain has been reduced to the point that now all kinds of other therapies are accessible to her. And this is something that we've found in general, that that people who come out of the sanctuary go into some kind of a cascading effect. It has an effect of that you that now things have become possible by which you are can now do other therapies that before were not accessible to you. People feel more robust, they feel more resilient, they feel inspired, and they make more use of the medical facilities that are available to them, not just taking themselves as passive patients, but as active people that are looking for also conventional medical cures that are out there. I've worked with people with cancer and that then have been able to move deeper into conventional medicine, go into unconventional places in conventional medicine, find new therapies because there is this enormous new focus of being an active part of your healing process. So it is a different relationship to conventional medicine, it's a different relationship to other forms of therapies. And she says what has happened is that in her house now she feels that she has brought the sanctuary home and that she is now part of this this healing trigger that comes whenever she needs it. She says, when I'm stuck in traffic and I begin to get uptight, all these healing triggers begin to work and I begin to relax and the tension goes out of my body. So I think I want to stop here in my general introduction, and let's go for 5 or 10 minutes with questions, and then we'll break and we'll do the rest of the questions after the break. So are there any... Yeah. Oh. Any immediate questions? Yeah?
Has Anne had other dreams since then that also help give her like new images?
Yes, but what she says is the thing that happens at the sanctuary is that it's so concentrated that level of concentration and that level of work she has never done again. So at some point she will come back. And we've had worked with one woman who has worked there. She was about 100 pounds overweight, and her doctor didn't allow her to have a certain operation, so she came to the sanctuary. She lost between two sanctuaries 75-80 pounds. And but she had to come back to do the work again because the concentration level of working your dream, being with a group of people that are completely focused on it, and then working your dream into art, working your dream into theater, working your dream into writing, into music, and all these kind of things, and all that in one single focus goes so far, and then sleeping in the abaton, it goes so far into imaginal space, you can't get there by yourself. So yes, she has dreams, but they're not as effective as they were when they were in the sanctuary. And we hear that also from the reports 2,000 years ago, that the effects of the dreams at the sanctuary were more dramatic. And there are many stories about that. One, two, yeah?
These situations and patients that present for sanctuary work are quite refractory. And you're talking about physical problems. It strikes me, I've been doing chronic pain management for about 30 more years,
yeah,
that this is really sounds as though the patients that present like this and the patients that we are frustrated with in clinic are really manifesting a somatization of psychotic proportions within the body, unintegrated aspects of the unconscious with a somatic expression, and this way of dealing with it breaks through, but there's still a lot of work to do.
Oh, yeah.
Post-treatment.
Absolutely.
So do you think that this is psychosis, a somatic psychosis? It's something I've been thinking about
yeah.
for the last several years.
Yeah. My first thing is, of course, I'm a phenomenologist. I'm more interested in the phenomena than what it is. The question what it is, I have recedes to me into the absolute I don't know. I have no idea what it is. And so I just look at the presenting phenomena. But if the notion that it is a psychosis in the body is something that can help you focus on these images, then it's a very useful way. But you have to realize that it may not actually help the phenomena. Because what we're trying to do, and what Asclepian medicine is different from what became medicine later afterwards, is that we are interested in what the phenomena have to say, and not so much what we say about the phenomena. And so that Robert De Niro starts to be present, that the kidnappers break it up, this is the same what you say, the fracturing of it and refracting, and it's becoming refracted in a different way. I think that looking at it as, if you look at psychosis, everything going all over the place and all these different voices beginning to talk at the same time, the way that, for instance, Zulu Sangoma told me that when too many spirits come at the same time, she faints because it is too much, she cannot handle it. That's another way of looking at it, so that too much is coming in at the same time. Yeah, I think it's a very useful way of looking at it because we all look at it through a lens, and since you work with pain management, you will look at it through a medical lens, and I think it's a very useful medical lens.
I'm very interested to know whether your dream work is only individual or whether you're working with groups, the whole group of six or seven, and I'd love to know more about how you're using the theater.
Okay. I think that I will ask it again after the, because that needs a longer one. Yeah? But ask it again, please. Yeah? Okay, so let's break and then go start with that one. So in the intermission, several people have come up to me and asked, how do you do this? And, well, for that, they've organized the workshop tomorrow. Right? Business. And in that workshop, what we will do is we will go through the basics of embodied imagination, the basics of getting into non-habitual states, and through dreaming and through memory, because you can, I was just asked what happens if you don't have dreams, you can do this work also through memory. And they don't even have to be childhood memories, they can be memories from last week. And so we will work on several techniques of re-entering the dream, or at least getting into a flashback of the dream, so memory techniques, and then some of the theater techniques that are useful to become in the grip of the image, because that's what we're trying to do. An embodiment is actually being embodied by, so we come into the grip of the image and we allow it to possess us. And in that possession, we begin to experience different things, and close to what Livingston is experiencing, though not that strong, because we don't have lions on our payroll. We will do all that with demonstrations. So people will present material, and on the basis of that material, we will do the work, and you will see what happens. So that is, it's a good deal, and it's really interesting, and et cetera, et cetera. Okay, there were several things that were... Ah, okay.
Tonight.
Yeah, can you say that again?
I'd be happy to take the registration for tomorrow's workshop.
Thank you. All right. Because we have to get that number higher up, right, over there. All right. Or is that not your numbers?
Oh, that's a fundraiser.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So maybe, okay, whatever. So there were several questions about groups, and let me start with that and then proceed from there. Much of the work that we did, that we have been doing, is work with groups. We started doing dream work. I started doing dream work in groups in the 70s, when that was very much frowned upon, because Jung never made a distinction between individuals and mobs. Anything that was over two people was a mob. So he never really understood group psychology at all. And so when I started doing it in the 70s, people were looking very askance at it. I find dream work in groups to be particularly useful, because what happens is that what we do usually in a dream group is that we have our general how are you and what's life like and what else horrible is happening to you. And then we take one dream and we work on that dream for an hour and a half. And everybody asks the questions. Everybody is involved with the dream, asking the questions, helping the person to stay in the image, stay still in the image, helping the person transit into non-self perspectives, helping it to go into the body. And as you do that, as the dream worker in the group, you get a lot of experiences yourself. So there are people that come to these dream groups that never dream, and that keep coming back because they can experience this through other people. Their own images begin to emerge, and it is a very powerful experience. So at a certain point, it became unmanageable, the amount of people, and so what we started to do in 1997, when it became possible, is we started Cyber Dream Work. And in Cyber Dream Work, people can go and work on dreams in groups on the internet. And thank goodness the internet is now so much better than it was in the previous century. It actually has continuity. I remember we were working on a dream in a group of a woman in South Africa. And first the internet broke down, and then 10 minutes later we started again. And the whole group was waiting because we knew that the internet would break down all the time. And then she said, she was very English. She said, "Oh, wait a moment. I think that my house is being broken into. I have to leave for a moment." And so you got a little bit of South African reality coming in. But anyway, so it works particularly well in groups, and if you want to know more about that, you can go to Cyber Dream Work, and it's for free, and you can join a group and see how that works in a group. But if there's specific questions about groups, let's start. I just wanted to give this as a general introduction. Or about anything. Don't ask me any business questions. I'm not good at that. Yeah?
Yes, I was wondering if you...
That's very different. Yes, I've been. I lived in Australia for 10 years, and I went to. I spoke with Nankaris, and I worked in the center in Australia a little bit, not much. But I talked with people about that. It's completely different. What happens with It's very interesting what happened is 2 years ago, the Freud Prize, which is the prize for psychoanalysis that is given out by the city of Vienna, was given to the collective of Nankaris from the center of Australia as the oldest psychotherapist in the world. Their psychotherapeutic tradition is 30,000 years old. But the way that it starts, when you want to become a Nankari, I started really young, right? I started at 23. One of the Nankaris told me, when I was 4 years old, there it begins, when I was 4 years old, my grandfather said, "You're ready." And he put his hand on my chest and his other hand on a tree, and I woke up 3 days later. So that we don't do usually. So, no, you can't really compare it. And what they do is they are actually, and this is what they describe in the Nankaris in the center describe, they can enter into other people's dreams in the way that they were talking about in the film Inception, which was, of course, Inception was based on video games. But this is in the actuality what they describe. I describe it in my book, Tracks in the Wilderness of Dreaming, the way that, that an Ankari can sweep into someone else's dream and take them and do a healing process while entering someone else's dream. Now, those technologies we don't have. There is a whole system of, it's very weird when you walk in the outback and somebody says, "Ah, yes, we were here, we knew," and they're standing there, they're waiting for you, and you hadn't told them that you were coming. So those kind of things are rather odd. Of course, there's a lot going on in Aboriginal culture that is so totally tragic. If you go to Alice and you see the alcoholism and the petrol sniffing and all that kind of stuff. So it's a completely different culture. And in Australia, there are many people that say, "Oh, my work is just like what you're doing." And they just, huh? But what is happening now is that they're working together. Western medical doctors and Western analysts are working together with the Nankaris because there are things that Nankaris are really good at, there are things that Western doctors are really good at, and so we're now working together, and that's a really good development. 1, 2, 3. Yes. So we have there's a 10-day process and there's a 7-day process.
Okay.
Yeah.
The Avatan, is that in the center?
Yeah, that's in the center. Yeah. So, yeah.
Do you wait for certain types of dreams or do you wait for a process in person?
Well, that's the problem. Right? In the olden days, you would wait for a dream, or you would wait for the priests would say, "Now you're ready to go to the abaton." We cannot do that because it could take a month. And so we have to structure it in a Western way. People frequently do it, take a week or 10 days off in a very busy schedule. And if you say, "Okay, I think you should stay another month," because it usually doesn't work. So we have to do this in a 21st century setting. And that is, I don't know if it's unfortunate. Actually, it pressurizes the work. Yeah, yeah. Like what we have done also is that we do what we call brief depth or brief and in depth, which is 8 sessions, a series of 8 sessions, and the psyche begins to adjust to that, because what happened very much is that's the way that especially Jungian analysis began, many of the early patients of Jung were Americans, and they would come for a period of 2 weeks, and then they would go back home. And during those two weeks, he would see them every day, or somebody of his circle would see them every day. And I spoke to people who did it that way, and they said about a week before we started to dream like crazy, and then we dreamt, and then the dream started to go away about 2 weeks afterwards. And so it seems that psyche adjusts to that, and the imagination begins to find its way. So it has advantages and disadvantages. That is the only thing that we're doing that is not authentic. For the rest, everything that we're doing was done there. Yeah, there was somebody over there.
Could you tell us how it was you came across Asclepius? Did you have a dream of him? Did he come to you? How did you decide to use that model?
Yeah. When you go to the Jung Institute, you can't avoid him because everybody talks about it. There's a whole discussion going on, who is our patron god? Is it Asclepius or Hermes? And so you begin very early on to discuss these things. But the most important thing for me that happened was that I became a staff analyst at this Asclepian psychiatric hospital. And that was completely unique. There was nothing else like it. It was Meyer and Tony Frey and Fiertz had started this as some kind of a vision that they were having of trying to pull that back in and to see what happens in very deep psychiatry, meaning psychosis and schizophrenia and manic depressive illness and all those, what happens there when you start working with dreams, and they had remarkable results. The one thing that is that you can't do that anymore because these treatments took a long time. I know people that were there for years. And so because it was Zurich and it was a center that a lot of people had heard about, people would come from all over the world, so that's how the clinic could survive. I don't know. So that's where I first heard about really that the Asclepian principles worked, and then I have been trying ever since to adjust it to contemporary reality, where people cannot spend years in a clinic and wait. And there are very many stories in from the olden days where there were hypochondriacs like Aurelius Aristides who stayed at the sanctuary for 12 years. He couldn't leave. He got addicted to the process. And so those kind of things we can't do. So we have to do a nugget of it, a very concentrated form of it. And what happened is that working on images made my symptoms go away, which Western medicine had not been able to do, even after having me in the hospital for 11 months. So I had great respect for what working with images could do. And the tradition of working with images on the physical body is the Asclepian tradition. And it's the basis of Western medicine. That's why we have now this non-profit foundation, which is the Asclepian Foundation of Western Medicine, because it's the foundation of Western medicine. There's somebody behind there, yeah? And then you. Yeah,
I was just wondering if when you had groups kind of come together, if you ever noticed common themes or synchronous kinds of images.
All the time.
Maybe synthesis between one person working on one thing and the other person working on a different side of the coin, as if there was a synthesis as the group was a whole. There was synthesis going on, maybe not just individually.
Well, I don't know if it's a synthesis. That is already one step removed. I know that there are themes and that groups begin to develop particular themes and that people suddenly exclaim, oh my God, that's just what you dreamt then and then when we worked that and that image. That is exactly what is going on over there. And then somebody else says, yeah. And then when you did that, then that figure came up and it's very similar to that. And then people, which comes usually after we do two phases of the work after the general misery of life. We do the laboratory phase and the oratory phase. The alchemist differentiated between the laboratory and the oratory. The laboratory is where you do the actual work, where you don't bring in anything from outside. The alchemists always say, don't bring in something from outside. And then the oratory, which is where you begin to talk about, well, the alchemist over there 500 years ago said this, which sounds like that, and the alchemist over there said this. So that's when you go and do these things where themes begin to come up, the Jungian notions of amplifications come up, where there are particular stories that seem to come to the fore that can be stories of movies or stories of myths or stories of gossip columns. It can be from all different sides. But you don't do amplification or you don't look at themes while you're in the laboratory. In the laboratory, you're just staying with the image. You stay with the phenomena, and the phenomenon, the word phenomenon means sense data. So you stay with the sense data, and you stay as close to the sense data as you can without putting a conceptual lens between. The conceptual lenses come afterwards. Yeah?
Yeah, I'm joining the narratives you're telling us and processing stuff. I'm thinking in the late 1960s, Gene Houston and Robert Masters wrote a book called Varieties of Dreamadelic Experience, although it might have been slightly different since they had the only 300 hits of legal LSD at the time in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And Salvador Capra was doing work with the natural hallucinogenics, and I'm wondering if there are any other narratives that seem particularly intense in the dream or transformative in the process that might come to mind or flash on.
Well, we worked with
and something about the kinds of things that you've done for yourself to deepen your own process.
Mm-hmm. In the clinic in Zurich, we had an LSD license. We worked with very low doses, 50 micrograms. Jimi Hendrix took 1,500 micrograms at Monterey Festival. So we took 50 micrograms, so it's called a psycholithic dose. And we would say that we would be with the patient as they were going through it, and it worked particularly well with depression and addiction. And for 8 hours we would be with the person, and then we would work on that one trip for months. It was extremely effective, but it was very intense. I mean, you would have to make a whole day, bless you, a whole day available, and then you would, from the clinic, you had to then for months afterwards follow it up. So I find that you can do similar things with dreaming. In dreaming, the non-habitual states come up all the time. Dreaming actually in its entirety is a non-habitual state. And so if you can, first of all, if you can move into a flashback of the dream, that's the prerequisite. If you don't move into a flashback, then you talk about the dream. But if you're in a flashback, and you're back in the dreaming environment, as you're back into that, you can begin to move around in it and you can begin to shift perspective. So you can move out of the perspective of N sitting next to Robert De Niro being over, oh my God, my daughter is going to notice, to Robert De Niro who doesn't care shit. And so it's a completely different body that you move into. And what I found is the advantage of working with dreams over hallucinogens, which I love, is the advantage of it is that it goes slow. It goes really slow. Even with 50 micrograms, which is a really low dose, it went fast as a freight train. And of course, the whole psychedelic things that were going on where they did usually 250 micrograms and more, that was like going on a rocket ship. And Jefferson Starship, and it's too fast. So what we're doing is we're able to slow it down. We do the alchemical way. The alchemical way is hurry slowly, and so you stay slow, and the intensity of it is the sense of hurrying, but you have to keep it back, hold it in, hold it back, and that's how you go really deep into the body, and that's how you get into ways that you can actually be truly affected permanently by non-habitual states. And that's what we're after, because I'm not interested in... I mean, I love it as entertainment. It's great entertainment. But psychotherapeutically, I don't think it's as valuable as going really slow.
Yeah?
In the late 80s and early 90s, Arne Mandel did work with dreaming processes and body symptoms.
Yeah.
That reminds me that I'm layering right onto what you're saying, and I'm wondering if that's appropriate or I'm missing something.
Yeah, I think that there's some similarity between Arne's work and mine. I knew him in Zurich when he was still the talking head, and then he got an illness, and then he got into his body, and so he did remarkable work. And the difference between his work and my work is that I work with the simultaneity of multiple perspectives. So I don't work just with one single perspective. What I'm trying to do is to create a network of perspectives, because I take a dream or an image to be an ecosystem in which all these things happen simultaneously. And if you do something there begins to happen. I won't go into that. And so... if you take a dream as an ecosystem, then you get closer to the dream the more perspectives you can embody simultaneously. And we do that by way of body memory. So what we do is, for instance, Robert De Niro becomes focused in this cocked head and this smile, and then the happy feet are going on in the feet, and the don't mess with me goes into the legs. And so this becomes what I call a composite, which is an alchemical term, a composite of multiple states. And as you hold this composite of multiple states, what happens is that a network of states comes into being, of embodied states. And in this network, nonlinear dynamics begin to happen. And so what my work is very much focused on is nonlinear dynamics and complexity theory. That means that if you complexify something to a certain point, that it just borders on chaos, you get the most creative state and transformations begin to happen.
It gets its own emergent qualities.
Yeah. So I'm working very much with the emergent phenomena. So that is different from the work that Arne is doing. Yeah?
I'm curious what the role is for meditation and yoga.
We have both meditation and yoga as very important modalities at the Healing Sanctuary. The day starts with it. And I think that they all bring a different element to it. And what the dreaming does is it moves into non-habitual states in one particular way, and we were just talking about it in the intermission, you and I, about that that meditation gets to non-habitual states in another way, and particular forms of meditation. Mm-hmm. And so what we are trying to do is to get into these non-habitual states, into a multiplicity of non-habitual states, but keep it connected to habitual consciousness. Always weave it back in. So a person will have had a very strong dream experience and will have worked how it goes into all the different ways of being and the way that it is in the body, and then meditation can straighten you out in a way, and you can go deeper into it in different ways. Yeah.
Doing yoga and meditation help people retain what they've experienced.
Correct. Correct. That's one of the great uses, especially of yoga. Yeah. And we have this amazing yoga therapist, and she can actually help a person. Even a person who is not very agile anymore, people with MS, to get into particular yoga states where they can still contain it. Yeah. There was still the question about dream theater. One, two.
The dream theater is what I wanted to bring up.
Oh, good. Look at that. We started developing dream theater in the 1970s. A book that was written about it was written by the person I think who got furthest with it. His name is John Lipsky. He recently died. And the book is called Dreaming Together, John Lipsky. It is a form of letting the characters of the dream come to the fore, and the whole group begins to act these different characters. This is not psychodrama. The idea of it is to articulate. It is not just expression. Like Jackson Pollock talks about that, he says, when I do just expression, it becomes something completely different than when I make my art. My art is articulation, and articulation is very different from self-expression. So we don't do just for the sake of expression, we do it for the sake of articulation. And so these beings become embodied by different character, by different people in the group. And as that happens, the narrative begins to shift, and what you're trying to do is you're trying to get to critical gestures. So you, when, for instance, I would be working in Dream Theater with the Robert De Niro character, I would try to just get into the thing in the neck, and then I would feel that thing in the neck, and I would move it on so that the whole body becomes the neck, and this cocking moment comes into the whole body, and then one person is doing that, and the dreamer is at that moment directing it, and then in the end, this is performed by the group, and the dreamer sits back, and the performance is taking place, and then at the end of the sanctuary, what we do is we take elements from each piece of theater, we put them together into one single narrative and have a group piece. So that's what we do. And it's very effective. Yeah? Yeah.
What about people coming into the sanctuary for emotional, relational issues?
Well, we have had very interesting things happen to couples. We have had several couples that come to the sanctuary as couples that want to work on their relationship. And we work on their physical problems. We work on all these different things. And the relationship, something begins to shift in the relationship. What I do with relationship work frequently is that I work with the three of us in a room, and we work on the dream of one partner together. The other partner becomes my assistant, and then we work on the dream of somebody of the other back and forth. And that's very effective, I found, because actually you get such a different view when your partner is going into a non-habitual state. You get such a different view of this person that there is a new person that you're with, and that has already an enormous effect. And so we find those things happening in the sanctuary very strongly, much more strongly than what I can do in my individual practice. The reason why we started the sanctuary is because I wanted to see if you could go further than what I can do in my individual work. And you can go much further, much further. Yeah? Yeah? What we do in the sanctuary is we have one psychodynamic group So that's where we talk about these things, and Jill runs them. And Jill has been doing groups for 50 years, actually. And so she has a lot of experience. And she finds that in the beginning we didn't do that. And the dynamics became very convoluted. And so that's why she put in, as the clinical director, she put in the dynamic groups. And that makes it possible to not get those things to happen. The worst danger is clique formation, and where people start to hang together and there is an in-group, out-group thing that starts to happen, and that you have to address immediately because that is goes against the whole process. And we haven't had it since the psychodynamic groups that we're doing. Yeah?
Have you ever considered sand play as a component?
I think sand play is extremely effective. And this, of course, leads to no. And especially what happened in China, when I've been working in China for 15 years, and mainland China, and so when the earthquake happened in Sichuan, a group of the people that we worked with started to go to orphanages and set up sentry rooms. And they have now set up more than 50 sanctuary rooms in 50 different orphanages in China. And it's extremely effective. And they do this embodiment work through sanctuaries. And I think that it would be a modality that I think wouldn't... It could be that we did it at the clinic. We had at the Zuriberg Clinic, we had a sanctuary room. I don't know if you do all these modalities that we're doing, I don't know if sanctuary would add much more to it. The answer is no, we haven't tried yet. I don't know if we will. But I really love sanctuary work. Does this mean that we've come to the natural end of the evening? It seems that way. Well, thank you all very much.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.